And now, a warrior for the Word of God and the Constitution of the United States, a Marine Corps veteran, a Harvard-trained attorney, Bishop of the Called Churches, and founder and president of STAND. Staying true to America's national destiny, the voice of the awakening, your host, Bishop E.W. Jackson.
Welcome to another edition of the Awakening Podcast on American Family Radio. Great to be with you again today, folks. Thank you for your support of our network. Thank you for your support of our entire American Family Association team, all the hosts that are on American Family Radio. We are so grateful to you, because without your support, your prayers, I doubt that we could accomplish what we're accomplishing. I don't see how we would do it without you. We are a team. You are part of that team, by the way. Let me be clear. You really are part of that team. All of those of you who are listening, thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm getting great reports on the numbers of people listening to it. And believe me, I am grateful to you and grateful to God, of course, for giving me the opportunity, the health, the strength, the wherewithal to be able to do this. So God bless each and every one of you for it. First, let me say, this is, you'll be hearing this program for the first time, at least, on Wednesday, April 3rd, although you can listen to it in our archives anytime. And by the way, you'll be able to watch it too, because I'm videotaping it. You'll be able to watch it too at a later time through my own podcast network, so to speak. But that's only after it is aired on American Family Radio. On May the 16th, as I've said before, we are hosting our Stand Awards dinner, and I'm very grateful to American Family Association, American Family Radio, Tim Wildman, the Wildman family, for being sponsors of the event. We're honoring five great patriots: Tina Deskovich, founder of Moms for Liberty; Kevin Freeman, who is the host of the Economic War Room, which airs on The Blaze, and he's also the founder of Liberty Hawk Ranch, just outside of Dallas, Texas. Great man of God. Walter Hoy, who has been one of the pioneers on dealing with the issue of killing unborn babies, particularly in the Black community. One of those unsung heroes that has been on the front lines for a long, long time. Stacy Washington used to be one of our hosts here on American Family Radio, has now gone on to do other things, but she has a program, I think, called Stacy on the Right that airs on another network. But Stacy Washington will be one of our honorees as well. And then the great Robert L. Woodson, who is the founder of the Woodson Institute and has really been a pioneer of conservative thought in this country. I really put him certainly in the generation and really of the same stature, except they were scholars and he's an activist, of Walter Williams, Thomas Sowell. Robert Woodson would really be among them, except Robert Woodson chose to be an activist rather than a scholar. And so perhaps because he hasn't written or spoken as much as those two did, certainly they did a lot of writing. I'm not so much, not so sure about speaking. He's probably not as well known as either of those. Of course, Walter Williams has departed from us. Thomas Sowell is in his 90s. He's still with us. Robert Woodson is in his mid-80s. And so we wanted to take an opportunity to honor him too. But it's a great lineup. You're going to have a great time. It is going to be uplifting, inspiring. You'll learn more about what STAND, my organization, does and what we've been doing to try to help save the country. There will be great singing. You'll hear from each of these honorees about their challenges and the things that they are confronting to solicit your prayers. So if you can come. Go to our website, standamerica.us. You're certainly invited. Standamerica.us, and you can donate, you can buy a ticket, you can reserve a table, you can sponsor the event. However you're led to support, I'm asking you for your support. Pray for us first and foremost, because I say prayer produces everything else that you need. But no matter what else you have, if you don't have God, you really don't have anything. So thank you all for that. That's Friday, May the 16th. It's going to be at Cornerstone Chapel where Pastor Gary Hamrick is the pastor. You all probably know of him. If you don't know him personally, you probably know of him because he's got a very, very big internet audience. And the church is one of the largest churches in Virginia. Okay, that's, again, Friday, May the 16th, Cornerstone Chapel, 7 p.m. Hope you can come. I hope you'll pray for us and support us, even if you can't make it. Okay. I want to talk to you today about DEI. And I really feel led to do this because, obviously, as an American of African ancestry, whenever DEI is mentioned, people would often think of Black folks, or maybe Hispanic folks, Asian folks, whatever, people who are not of European ancestry, Americans who are not of European ancestry. I want to suggest to you that's really the wrong way to look at DEI, because I don't think that that's ultimately what it's about. So let me step back a second and talk about something that I think is critical to understand. After segregation ended in the South with the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Movement, and segregation ended, and we began to move toward a more colorblind society. I mean, by fits and starts, obviously, and it was not an easy thing to do because I have argued racism in America is not something that the American people are or ever were imbued with. Racism in America is something that was created by the slave master class to affirm and protect their way of life. Little known facts. You all probably know it. If you've been listening to me long enough, you probably know it. Based upon the total population of the country, North and South, only 5% of the American people ever owned slaves. 5%. I say at the start of the Civil War. 5%. You'd think it was 95%, but 5%, that's it. In the South, even when leftists tried to blow this up and try to make this far bigger than it was, and I'm not trying to minimize the evil of slavery. Slavery was a pernicious evil everywhere it was practiced, and of course it's been practiced throughout human history. But nevertheless, even if one takes the most broad approach to slave ownership in the South, only about 30% of the people in the South owned slaves. And in order to get to 30%, you have to include wives, children, extended family if they're living on that property, on that plantation, of the actual patriarch, the person who actually, in whose name the property actually is owned. You have to add all those people in. And if you do that, then you can get to about 30%, a little bit higher. But that's it. That means almost 70% of the people, even in the South, did not own slaves. So the slave master class had a problem, and the problem started with Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion, and I think in about 1641. And the problem was they had to convince people who were not wealthy enough to own slaves or did not have property or were not doing well enough to even think about owning slaves. They were too busy trying to think about how to eke out an existence for themselves. You have to convince those people that even though slavery robs them of work, robs them of the opportunity for gainful employment, robs them of being paid for doing a job that they're not needed to do because slaves can do it. So even though it is not in their interest at all, you've got to convince them that it is, that it's a good thing, that it's an appropriate thing. Even though, frankly, folks, for the average worker, it was a horrible thing. Because not only were you competing against slave labor for the people who had enough resources to hire people, but you were even competing against slaves who were taught certain skills, blacksmithing, carpentry, brick masons, brick masonry. The slave masters were smart enough to have their slaves taught these skills because not only did it help them on the plantation, but they could farm them out to others and reap the benefit of the slave being paid. And the money, of course, would go to the slave master, the slave being paid. So that means even if you are a skilled laborer, you still potentially have got to compete with slave labor, which is impossible to do. Again, that's why West Virginia was ultimately formed, because those folks realized this Virginia as a slave state, it's not helping us. It's not doing anything for us. I mean, all it was really doing was propping up the lifestyle of the slave master class. But this is why, folks, I simply, and forgive me, because I know there are people who don't understand this. I trust you all will. I simply can't get into the, we need to reconcile and your ancestors owe, you owe me an apology because your ancestors enslaved my ancestors. I mean, I just find that stuff. I am unmoved by all that. Because first of all, when you know the real history and you know how few people there actually were who owned slaves, and then when you add to that the fact that people who weren't wealthy enough to own slaves were manipulated into believing that they were somehow better off because black people were slaves and they weren't. Well, I mean, I guess they were better off that they weren't slaves, but they certainly weren't better off economically because black people weren't slaves, because those people, those black people were taking work away from them. I mean, you got a whole crop that you need to bring in, and you got a whole group of people who don't have work anywhere, and they're looking for work. You don't need them because you got slaves to do it. So, you know, I know it, all the racial reconciliation stuff is well-meaning, but I just don't feel I need to be reconciled with anybody because I don't feel I have a problem with anybody. I've never been a slave, and nobody I know who happens to be of European ancestry has ever owned slaves. Now, maybe their ancestors did, maybe they didn't. We know more likely that they didn't, but maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but who cares? Has nothing to do with me. So I just can't get into it. I can't get into the mea culpas. You know, I mean, two, three generations ago, somebody's supposed to be apologizing to me for something that their ancestors may have done, that my ancestors may have experienced. And all of it is really just a lot of, it's fantasy. Even if there were a real person, I've heard of this, who found out that somebody that they actually knew or met actually had ancestors who owned the black person's ancestors, what does that have to do with us today? I mean, really, what does it have to do with us today? And when, again, when you consider, and this is also a fact, every single one of you listening to me right now, every single one of you, more likely than not, had ancestors who were slaves. More likely than not. Because unless, I mean, this is true for Italy, the Italian peasants were slaves, certainly true for Russia, the Serbs were slaves, certainly true in Great Britain, they tried to enslave the Irish. Unless you came from royalty or wealth, that was probably your position in life. Even if you weren't formally a slave, and for example, in the southern Italians were treated by the wealthier northern Italians like they were their slaves on call. So even if you there was not paperwork to show that you were owned, you could be called upon any time. The serfs in Russia, scholars called that the peculiar institution, because the serfs in Russia literally could not even move without the feudal lord's permission, could not go anywhere, could not leave the land that they were assigned to. I mean, I've even heard of slaves in the South that they could go from one plantation to another to meet people, and did. a fairly widespread racial ideology now that has infected the country. There's no question about it. Has infected the country with stereotypes like black people are intellectually inferior. They all they want to do is dance and party and drink, and you know all these stereotypes. Which, by the way, you know, the British did the same thing to the Irish. Since it almost exactly the same thing verbatim, which is again why I say it's not the skin, it's the sin. So you're coming out of that, and in the early 1970s, Richard Nixon was the one who pioneered this. Comes up with this idea. Well, let's do something to incentivize hiring Americans of African ancestry and getting them fully involved in the economic life of the nation. And he came up with the set-aside program. The set-aside program meant the 10%, said the 10% of federal contracts had to go to a minority, later to a woman. And of course, we know people took advantage of that because they would go out and pluck some black person or pluck some woman up and turn them into a front and then use them. But the money was going to the big owner, the owner of the big company that could actually do the work that they were being hired to do. So a lot of it was a scam from the very beginning. Not all of it, but a lot of it was. So you went from that, from the set aside, to affirmative action. Now, believe it or not, folks, I didn't have a problem with affirmative action, and still don't, depending on how you define it. If you define affirmative action as white people can get one, must get one test score, black people can get a lower test score, I abhor that. That to me is absolutely anathema to everything this country stands for, and it ought to be anathema to any human being who is told you're too inferior to be able to rise to the level of your peer of a different demographic group, and so we're going to lower the standards for you. I find that just insulting, just absolutely abhorrent. But you see, that's the beginning of the whole equity movement. I didn't have a problem with this. When I graduated from high school, I did very well academically. But because my father only had a sixth grade education and there was nobody in my family who was educated at all, nobody. I had no idea about how to choose a college, about how college rankings went, about what your academic performance could do for you. I didn't have a guidance counselor who sat down with me as a person who had done well academically and said, look, you, there's some opportunities here for you. I got letters of recruitment from schools, but I didn't really know what it meant. I didn't know how the schools were ranked. The kind of affirmative action that says not to a person because they're black, but says to a person because maybe they come from a background where they are not exposed to certain things or certain information, that says, I want to sit down with you and I want to kind of give you the lay of the land. I want to help you better understand. In other words, I want to help you at least bridge a little bit of the gap so that you understand the way my children understand. When it's time for my children to go to college, they had educated parents with 5 degrees between us. There was no question of how college worked, what colleges were ranked, what they were looking for. I mean, because my wife and I had fully experienced it. But when I was going, getting ready for college, I didn't have anybody around me who knew that. My children didn't need any affirmative action like that because they could talk to their parents. But I was not in a position to talk to my parents about that, and I didn't have anybody else to talk to. So basically, I just kind of spun the wheel. You know, just say, okay, I didn't know any better. That kind of affirmative action that says, let's take, and here again, not based on race, but based on the economic or social conditions that a child is raised in, that seeks to help that child better understand their options, better understand how to maneuver through. Here you got a kid maybe who's talented or gifted, maybe he's technically gifted, okay? But doesn't know anything about technical colleges, doesn't know anything about opportunities, and have somebody be able to say, okay, look, here's the lay of the land, okay? Here's what you need to understand. To me, that's an appropriate. what all you for anyone who came from a similar background that I came from, again, regardless of their skin color. See, this is where you get away from skin color and you just deal with the economic and social realities people deal with. I found out that stuff I was being exposed to for the first time, there were kids at Harvard Law School who were about to be third generation lawyers. They had been exposed to the law and the legal system all of their lives and had been around lawyers all of their lives. It was all brand new to me. Okay, that's fine. That's life. But here's what, so affirmative action, trying to lower the standards, trying to change, well, you know, if you're this race, you have to do this. If you're this, I mean, that stuff is abhorrent and it should be ended completely and totally and never, ever, ever used again. Because look, it does two things. Number one, it dumbs down the entire population because it says merit is not what's important, but somehow your immutable outward physiological characteristics are what's important. So if your skin color is the most important thing, then your competence can't be the most important thing. Your capability can't be the most important thing. And it should be the most important thing. But here's the other thing it does. It casts a pall on every person who is or could be the beneficiary of this affirmative action. Because what it suggests is, oh, you're a lawyer? Oh, okay. But yeah, he might be a lawyer, but we know he probably didn't pass the bar exam, or he probably took five times to pass it, or probably just barely passed it, or he didn't have to get the same score on the LSATs that somebody else did. So we know he's not capable of doing the same things another lawyer. Let's look elsewhere. Let's look for somebody who we know is competent. Well, folks, that's another reason why I have abhorred and hated that whole thing, because you work your backside off, you study. I told you all, when I passed two bar exams at the same time. I sent my wife away 3 weeks or a month, my wife and my child away, my son away 3 weeks for a month, so that I could just study day and night, day and night, day and night, day and night, because I knew I had two bar exams to pass, not one, and I passed them both on the first time. You work yourself to a frazzle, you achieve something, and then here comes some pinhead liberal along to say, well, but you know, we understand you can't meet the standards others meet, but it's okay. We'll hold your hand and walk you through it and try to treat you like you're equal anyway, even though you're not. That's what it really comes down to. And then, you know, you walk into a doctor's office, that doctor happens to be black. Well, is that doctor a doctor because he or she was an outstanding academic performer and an outstanding internist? Or is that person a doctor because somebody just said, well, you know, we need more black doctors. Yeah, I know. I know he failed chemistry. I know he failed biology. But let's figure out a way to get around that. That's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but you get my point. I mean, have you all heard about this young lady? This story broke a couple weeks ago. Graduated from high school with honors. She could not read. She figured out how to game the system. And basically what she was doing was she had an app that would translate words into writing, so she wasn't writing her own stuff. She was dictating it, and then this app was writing it. And then the app would also translate writing into words. So she was basically just gaming the system, clearly smart enough to do all that. But they never taught the child to read. And she graduated with honors illiterate. Now you see, folks, to me, that is affirmative action. Because when I was in sixth grade, I will never forget this, Mr. Charles Ballard, he put a book in your hand and you had to open that book and read it out loud to the class. And there wasn't any getting by that. And I say I remember it because I remember the first time I read in Mr. Ballard's class, or maybe it wasn't the first time, but at some point, maybe it was. But after I finished reading, Mr. Ballard stopped the whole class and said, "Now you see Mr. Jackson here, did you see what he just did?" And what happened was I'd come to a word I wasn't quite sure of, but I sounded it out and then kept going. I said, then he pointed out, "Did you see how he did not stop and go back at the beginning of the paragraph or the first thing? He just sounded that word out and then just kept flowing with it. That's what I want you all to do." And I thought, well, look at me. I know it may seem a small thing, but in the life of a kid who'd been in foster care and almost failed out of fifth grade, for my teacher to commend me for my reading, man, that was a big deal in my mind. But I had to read. How do you graduate from high school and you can't read? Affirmative action. We're overlooking your deficits. Because after all, you know, we know you can't live up to them anyway. And folks, that, you know, the one thing, not a whole lot I agreed with George Bush too about, but the one thing I agree with him about is when he said that, I don't know what he was referring to exactly, but when he talked about the bigotry of low expectations. And that is bigotry, because what you're saying is people are inferior. So, all right, so we go from desegregation, okay, to set-asides, we could debate, you know, set asides here again, I mean, because the whole system got abused, to affirmative action, but that's not enough. Because now we go to full-blown equity. Because, see, affirmative action contains those equitable elements. The equitable element says, I might not be as gifted as you are in something, but I'm going to be treated like I am because the color of my skin entitles me to that because of what my ancestors have gone through or something like that. And so you have to take a back seat now because I need to be promoted now, even though you're better at this than I am, but you have to take a back seat now because I need to be promoted because of what your ancestors did to my ancestors, or again, or something like that. Folks, diversity, equity, and inclusion is one of the most abominable things that has ever happened to this country. It divides us. It dumbs people down. And perhaps worst of all, it deprives the country of the very thing that is one of the things, at least, one of the essential things that has made us the greatest nation on earth, which is striving for excellence in everything we do. Meritocracy, ability, competence. You know, you all may have heard me tell this story before, but I'll tell you, it just like that story about Charles Ballard, my teacher, my sixth grade teacher. My daddy was a third grade welder, I should say third class welder, at Sunship Building and Dry Dock Company in Chester, Pennsylvania. And my father is, again, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but this is, it's relevant. My father was a left-hander, but because of the prejudices of that time, and some of you will relate to exactly what I'm talking about, as I've heard other people refer to this, they would try to force you to be a right-hander because they thought being a left-hander was a curse or something. And being left-handed was a curse. And, you know, you got to make you right-handed. So my grandfather forced my father to use his right hand, even though my father was a natural left-hander. And so what my father ended up being was ambidextrous. He ended up being able to do things as well with the right hand as he could do with the left, pretty much. You almost couldn't tell the difference. He could write as well with his right hand as he could write with his left hand because they forced him to use it, but he was a natural left-hander. Well, my father then, as a welder, could weld equally well with both hands, which is very rare, apparently. Weld as well with one hand, which is their dominant hand. If you're a welder, you weld with your right hand. Well, guess what that meant? That meant that my father could weld things and get into places and do things that others couldn't, because he could weld with his right hand or weld with his left hand equally well. And my father would say, after he'd done a job and a supervisor would come to inspect the job, and I don't understand all of this, of course, but my father said they had a slag hammer, and you hit that well with the slag hammer and the slag drops off the well, so you can see the perfection or the imperfections of the well. And my father used to say, I'll tell you what, when that supervisor looks at that well that I did and hits it with that slag hammer, he said, I just stand there and look. He said, because I know there's nobody in this shipyard that can weld better than I do. And it made me realize, and as I got older, I reflected on this, that even though my father was discriminated against in ways I'll never know personally, because it was a different era, but he was committed to excellence in what he did, and he was proud of a job well done. And again, that marked me as well. I mean, because it made me realize, whatever you're doing and whatever the circumstances in which you are doing it, do it to the very best of your ability and accept no standard less than excellence, the highest level to which you can go. I mean, can you imagine? My father's welding ships. Those ships hold people. Those people's safety and well-being on the high seas depend upon the expertise of people doing jobs like that to make sure that that ship is not going to come apart. In other words, lives are literally in your hands. Can you imagine somebody coming along and saying, well, you don't have to weld as good as somebody else. A little leak here and there won't hurt. I mean, right, you hear me say that, you go, yeah, that would be insane, appalling. Is that any different than saying, well, you know, black people don't do well on standardized tests, and they don't do well on the bar exam, and they don't do well on the MCATs, and they don't do well on the medical boards, and so we got to lower the standards, and Hispanics, is it any different? Don't these folks doing these important jobs hold the lives of others in their hands? So equity is trying to pretend that based upon the demographic group to which a person belongs, they should somehow be elevated whether they are capable of doing that particular role at the level at which it's needed or not. That's insane, folks. It's suicidal, is what it is. Now, part of what prompted me to get into this subject is that Stephen A. Smith had the nerve to come on, which with his, I mean, he thinks he's so intelligent, but he's, you know what, he's vastly overrated himself, because if he were, he wouldn't be such a leftist, and he is a leftist. Oh, every now and then he sounds a moderate tone, but he's a leftist. And he wants, I will debate President Trump. I will debate J.D. Vance. I will debate Pete Hedgesmith, Hedseth on DEI. Well, you lose. And you know what my thought is? Hey, Stephen A., you don't need to debate them. You can debate me. I'll make it easy on you. So maybe you'll be less embarrassed. You don't have to tell anybody. It doesn't have to be a national debate, because they're not going to debate Stephen A. Smith anyway. I mean, that would be ridiculous. Why would they do that? But I could explain to him how pernicious it is and why it needs to be done away with. Because here's the first thing I would say to Stephen A. Smith. I would say to him, so let's just say, Stephen A., that you are of a different background. Okay, let's just pretend for the moment that you are of a different skin color, of a different ancestral background. And along comes a black guy, okay, or an Asian guy, or Hispanic guy, who You clearly know is not as articulate as you are. He is not as well-versed as you are in sports. He doesn't have the same level of expertise that you have. You know that. You know that. You know that because you listen to him and you realize, oh my goodness, he doesn't meet my standards. But they say to you, but Stephen A., we know that. You may know that, but you know what? We need one of his kind here. So we got to let you go. We got to put you in the background. And I mean, how would you? Suppose you say, well, wait a minute, but that's not fair. They say, oh, but no, Stephen A., you don't understand. You know, he comes from a poor background. His mother was a welfare queen. Or he comes from foster. He was in foster care, like me, and comes from a broken home. And, you know, and his foster parents were illiterate. So you understand. I mean, it's no reflection on you, but it's not expertise and ability that is the most important thing here. It's equity. And you know what? He's not as smart as he thinks he is, but he's smart enough to get that. See, equity pretends that all people should somehow have equal results, and that's not possible, and it's not reasonable. And let me tell you something else. It leads to tyranny when you try to do that. That's what communists try to do. I've got a friend who is a pastor and a singer. And I'll tell you what, I started to say boy, but he's a man, but I would say boy affectionately. But he can sing the roof off the building. Now, you know what? I wish I could do that. But I can't. I can hold a tune occasionally. If you're ever near me in a worship service, you might hear me sing. It sounds pretty good for a little bit, but don't hit two notes too high, too low, and don't go too far, because you will find out the limits of my musical ability very, very quickly. This guy can hit notes high and low. There's no such thing as equity, folks, because we're not all the same. We are different as individuals. Not only do we have different backgrounds, we come from different places, we've had different experiences, but we have different inherent gifts and talents and abilities. And that's the reality. And those gifts and talents and abilities are not distributed on the basis of racial demographics. They're distributed on the basis of individuals. Now, for whatever reason, you may have one demographic that seems to excel in a particular thing, but as Thomas Sowell has often pointed out, that may persist for a time, but then you look at another time and you realize, oh, well, that's gone. That phenomenon that you thought you were witnessing and you thought maybe was some sort of permanent attribute is gone. Equity is a myth. The only thing you can do is unleash people to fulfill their God-given gifts and potential and go to the highest place to which they are capable. That's all. And some people are going to go higher than others. And some people are going to go different places than others. And some people are going to want to do different things than others. And that's fine. But when you start trying to engineer what they call equity, you are playing with fire. And that's exactly what the left has been doing. We don't need engineered diversity in the country. You know why? Because America's the most diverse nation in the history of mankind. That's right. And you know what? If you leave people alone, that'll take care of itself. Not because somebody is engineering it or ordering it, but because people will find their niche, they'll find their place. And if we're treating each other as individuals and we're evaluating each other, as Dr. King said, on the basis of the content of our character and, of course, our competence, our capability, people will find their place. They will find their place. They will, again, if you don't put artificial obstacles in front of people, they will find their place. You know, I don't have a big organization, but I've hired, we've been in existence 16 years. Oh, my goodness, I probably hired, 20, 25 employees over that time. I've hired men and women. I've hired black, white, Hispanic, Asian. I've hired people from all kinds of backgrounds. You know what I look for when I hired them? I look for their ability. I look for whether the person had the character to follow through on the job. Because we have a virtual office. I look for whether this is a person who's responsible enough that they're going to get up every morning and go to work, even though there's not an office for them to report to or somebody looking over their shoulder. And you know what I found? There have been times when my staff was predominantly white. There's been times when my staff was predominantly black. There's been times when my staff was a mixture of the two. And I just roll with it because I'm not interested in counting heads. I'm interested in counting capability. And you know what? The same thing will happen for our country and the same thing will happen for our institutions if we just treat every individual as that and actually try to objectively assess that person's capability for the task at hand. But here's the last thing I want to mention about this, and it's as important as anything else I've said so far. Diversity, equity, and inclusion has been polluted to be even worse than if it only dealt with race, and that would be bad enough. This artificial imposition of some kind of racial formula on people, that would be bad enough. But you know what? That's not even its primary purpose anymore. You know what its primary purpose is? Its primary purpose is to make sure that you hire the drag queen, to make sure that you bring the flamboyant homosexual in, to make sure that the person who's non-binary, he doesn't know whether he's a man or a woman, he's trying to be both of them, and so he's one thing one day and one thing another. Make sure that you bring those people in, and you can say, that's, they've got to be included. One of the most devastating things that we've got to get rid of in our culture, one of the most devastating things that the left has done is to equate sexual orientation, sexual proclivities, sexual deviancy, sexual diversion, sexual perversion with race. If you notice it, folks, barely does race or racism get mentioned now that people don't throw in this stolen word that they took out of vocabulary and again perverted it like the perverse lives that they live, which is gay. Black and gay, gay and black, black and gay, 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 black and gay. I mean, they may as well make it one word. But a person's sexual proclivities has nothing to do with the immutable characteristic of their skin color or their ancestral background. I said, if I walk into a room and it's of interest to people, they don't have to have a debate about whether I'm black or whether I have any African ancestry in my background. It's obvious. A person who walks in the room who happens to be a homosexual, but dressed normally, not dressed like some flamboyant whatever, dressed normally, looking normally, acting normally, would you know that that person's a homosexual? Would I know? Absolutely not. Well, we say, well, let's get away from him. He's a homosexual. No, we don't know. And guess what? If the person doesn't make it an issue and the person doesn't shove it in your face, you know what you're going to do with them? You're going to treat them just like you would any other human being. And we're going to do that anyway, even if you know, but you don't know. So you're not going to say, before we start a discussion, are you homosexual? I mean, Nobody does that. In other words, there is a difference between private sexual behavior and the desire of people to engage in that behavior and outward, obvious, immutable, physiological characteristics that are unchangeable. I mean, we as Christians know too many people, I do, who were, Janet Boynes is one, who were practicing homosexuals. God delivered them and they walked away from it. And I've had people testify, I have absolutely no interest in same-sex relationships. God took it away from me. It's gone. Because, of course, we know it also has moral implications. There's no moral applications to the complexion of your skin. But there are moral applications to what people choose to do sexually. And when a person's delivered from that and says, I no longer have any interest in that whatsoever, it's as if I never, ever knew such behavior. Because God took it from me. Well, clearly, that's not an immutable characteristic. It is a moral failing. And God delivered them from that moral failing. But the complexion of your skin is not a moral failing. It has no impact whatsoever on your character, on your competence, on your capability, unless you just choose from whatever background you come to wallow in it and make it an excuse for being a do-nothing. And you know, people can do that, certainly. Doesn't matter what background they are. I mean, they can do that and blame their background all they want. But if you choose not to do that, your ancestral background has absolutely no bearing on your ability or on what you accomplish or what you achieve or what you do. I want to say to people like Stephen A. Smith who think they're so wise and think they're so just and so right, DEI is like a cancer on the body politic, keeping us from becoming what our founding fathers intended, and more importantly, what God intended, which is to be one nation under God. That's the only way we're going to be indivisible and have liberty and justice for all. Jesus said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And DEI is nothing but a nuclear bomb of division that is dropped into the middle of our country society. And that's why President Trump and Pete Hegseth are absolutely right. Get it out of the military. The military is too busy training and developing themselves for the purpose of defending the safety and security of our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to get hung up in all of this so-called DEI nonsense. I mean, look, when Dr. King said, I have a dream that one day my four little children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I said that was a dream of individual liberty. He wouldn't have put it that way, and others haven't said that, but that's what it was. Because what you're saying is you want your children not to be seen as black, but to be seen as individuals with their own capabilities, their own talents, their own drives, their own ambitions, their own perspectives. You want them to be seen as individuals. Folks, that's the future of America. That I really believe that's what the founding fathers envisioned. They may not have fully envisioned that we would be the most diverse nation on earth. They may not have fully envisioned that those few slaves that the country had when they were there would become millions, would become 11, 12, 13% of the population of our country. They may not have envisioned that, but I really believe that they envisioned a nation of individual liberty. I know that's what they had in mind because they said so. So everywhere it's found, it needs to be eliminated. And there needs to be a decoupling of homosexuality and racial and demographic background, ancestry, because the two have absolutely nothing to do with one another. Homosexuality is about your private sexual proclivities and desires and all of that. And ancestry and demographics and race are about things that have absolutely nothing to do with the choice of the individual. You didn't choose to have Irish ancestry or Scandinavian ancestry or German ancestry or Italian ancestry. I didn't choose to have African ancestry, and I have some British ancestry too. I didn't choose any of that. What I get to choose is what I do with my life. And if we leave it to the American people to just do that, you know what? We won't even need to talk about, and we don't need to talk about diversity. That'll take care of itself. And we certainly don't need to be talking about equity, because there is no such thing in life. Equality of opportunity, yes, to the extent that we can create that, yes, wonderful. And that's and still, that's an ideal, but it's not real. It's not, you can't make that perfectly. You can't do that perfectly. I mean, look, the children of Donald Trump are going to have opportunities that I would never have had. But my children have opportunities that I never had. I said, I just got back from a trip to Europe and Israel, my first time to Europe. Two of my children have been to Europe several times already. We have to treat people as individuals, not as representatives of some demographic group. You don't walk up to an Irish person and say, how's the beer? You know, you don't walk up to an Italian person and say, what kind of wine did you drink this morning? You all forgive me, but you know, the stereotypes people come up with based on, you know. You don't walk up to a person who's German. How's the sauerkraut? Maybe that person may be of German ancestry and doesn't like sauerkraut. And you don't walk up to a black person and say, boy, I tell you what, yeah, I'm sure you can dance. Because everything you've said there could be completely untrue for the person you're saying it to, but you're saying it because you think you understand that person based on what you think you understand about that group. Okay, I gotta go. I hope you all accept that. I'm being humorous now, obviously. We don't do these things to people, but that's really what the left wants us to do. That's how they want us to view each other. That's what DEI is all about. And you know what? DEI needs to be dead and buried, never to rise again. In fact, you know what? I don't even need to debate Stephen A. Smith. He can just send him a copy of this, and that'll take care of it. By the time he listens to this, he won't even have any questions. He won't want to debate the president and the vice president and Pete Hegseth. He won't need to. This will be enough. All right, folks, I've got to go. Listen, God bless each and every one of you. You know what to do. Stand up, step up, speak up, and refuse to back up. Because we cannot be defeated if we will not quit. Because we are on God's side. God bless everybody.